Europe is facing an explosion of far-right movements not seen since the Second World War.
Across Europe, far-right parties are gaining ground. Poland has seen regular far-right demonstrations and is controlled by the ultra-nationalist Law and Justice Party. In Austria, the Freedom Party is part of the governing coalition. It has roots in the country's Nazi past.
People want their countries back, and people want their nations back, and people want their identities back.
It's not racist or xenophobic to control national borders. We face harassment and persecution from the Muslims, leftists, and the state.
This new fascism is well-financed, increasingly transnational, and intent on turning the clock back decades on democracy, human rights, gender politics, and the freedoms of minorities.
It is against the established order. It's against the established way things are. And I think it's what scares people.
What is it that's tantalizing millions of Europeans into this hallucination of the past? And how can civil society and progressive activists respond? These are the questions we're discussing on our first ever live international edition of the Another Europe is Possible podcast in Vienna, with Luke Cooper, a visiting fellow at the IWM, and Zoe Williams from The Guardian. Joining us on today's panel are two leading lights of the European academic community. Rafał Pankowski is a sociologist based in Warsaw. His four books on Polish fascism and his irrepressible campaigning on anti-Semitism and minority rights in Poland has moved the ruling far-right Law and Justice Party to denounce him as an enemy of the state.
It's an extraordinary situation. Democracy as such is under threat. The rule of law, the basic constitutional principles, the freedom of the media, the basic democratic values are under threat.
Ruth Vordak is an award-winning linguist based in Lancaster and Vienna. She's a leading specialist on European fascism and an outspoken critic of the ruling Freedom Party in Austria. Her indispensable 2015 book, The Politics of Fear, mercilessly dismantled the strategies and fictions of Europe's right-wing populists.
It's about saying something unsayable, and so the whole media jumps on it. And while this is happening, all the other policies are being decided upon quite frequently in very undemocratic ways.
To feed back to us on today's podcast, you can find us on Twitter at @another_Europe. And you can also get us on Facebook /AnotherEuropeIsPossible. Hope you enjoy it.
Thanks so many of you for coming today. My name's Luke Cooper. I'm a visiting fellow here at the IWM, and with Zoe Williams from The Guardian, we co-host the Another Europe podcast. So maybe I'll go to Rafał first on this one. Who are the far right and what do they want?
It's a tricky question, obviously, but I would say it's especially tricky in the current Polish context because we no longer know what is the far right and what is not the far right, what is the mainstream right. I think it is an important distinction in a democratic society. There is nothing automatically evil about being a conservative or somebody with a right-wing outlook, but clearly the distinction is becoming more and more problematic in the Polish context, where the demarcation line between the normal part of the democratic spectrum, the mainstream right on the one hand, like the current ruling party, and on the other hand, the extreme anti-democratic nationalist groups like the National Radical Camp, which is a street movement which takes its name from the original fascist group that existed in Poland in the 1930s. Again, the distinction between the rhetoric, the discourse the mainstream right uses and the far right uses is becoming less and less clear. And we have seen it more and more in the last 2 or 3 years, not least in the form of hate speech against various minority groups that is no longer confined to the far right fringe, but it comes from the political mainstream, including, very importantly, from the state-owned media, the government-controlled media, that today is one of the main actors that pushes hate speech against minority groups, but also against people they consider critics or opponents, and such people are routinely labeled as traitors to the nation on the state media. So what we are talking about is really the fundamental issue of the national community, the construction of the national community, who is in, who is out, who belongs, who doesn't belong. And I am afraid the criteria of belonging that are present in the mainstream discourse are very similar to the criteria promoted by the far right.
And Ruth, you've been prominent, let's say, in recent weeks in Austria, but have obviously written on these questions for a long time. In the Austrian case, what is it exactly that we're dealing with?
If we would know, that would be good. The phenomenon in Austria is not that new, and I think it's important to see it a bit in a more historical context. If you think back in Austria, and we've talked a few times about this, basically this rhetoric of exclusion and also the issue of who's a real Austrian, this nativism, so it's not just nationalism, but it's a nativist nationalism transferred over blood, which really insinuates National Socialist or fascist ideologies. That started already post-war, because the Austrian Freedom Party, which was the VDU post-war, is the successor party of the NSDAP. So in Austria, the far right draws on that tradition. That doesn't mean that everybody who's in the Freedom Party is a Nazi, but there is this strong ideological tradition which feeds into the Freedom Party to date. And already 1989, when the Iron Curtain fell, Haider sort of started and launched a very strong rhetoric of exclusion at that time against people coming from the former Eastern Bloc countries. So they were white and Christian, so religion wasn't the issue. The issue was they were migrants, and they were defined as threatening us, taking our jobs away. They were different. The whole phenomenon of the young men who were threatening our women was already apparent at that time. And if we then go further along, we have sort of a peak of this Haiderization, 1999, where the Haider Party, the Freedom Party, already had 27% of the votes in a national election. That was before 9/11. Then we notice a discursive shift. So from the othering towards people coming from the former Eastern Bloc countries towards excluding Muslims. So that became one of the priorities of Strache, who followed Haider as leader of the Austrian Freedom Party. And suddenly it becomes an issue of religion very strongly. Sort of, we don't want minarets, they are different. So a culturalization of that discourse. And then comes the refugee movement, 2015. And the patterns of the rhetoric are very similar to the patterns 1989, it's just different protagonists. Mm-hmm. So they're Syrians, Iraqis, Afghanis, and so forth. And formerly, 1989, there were Poles, Hungarians, Czechs, Romanians. But now it's basically about Muslims. But the interesting issue in Austria, and the same is true, I think, in Hungary and Poland and Romania, is that it's connected also to anti-Semitism. So it's not the case that this anti-Muslim sentiments have substituted anti-Semitism in Central Europe. It's connected, and we have this overall Feindbild of Soros, who seems to pull the strings behind everything and is also pulling the strings so that the Muslims come to Hungary and the Mexicans come to the US and whatnot. And so you have an argumentation pattern of, first, there is this lobby of powerful Jews, and they drive the Muslims, and the Muslims will overtake the white Christian Europe. And that is very strong also in Austria. And I think that's what makes the rhetoric of fear, that we might be overwhelmed by these strangers.
This podcast was sponsored by the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation, funded by the German federal government, and hosted by the Institute of Human Sciences in Vienna.
When I was thinking about this question, I was wondering, well, is the answer really Sebastian Kurz, Boris Johnson, Jacob Rees-Mogg, and Donald Trump? I mean, in a sense, all of those figures have in common what Raphael was talking about, this blurring of the distinctions. You don't know where you are anymore between mainstream conservatism and traditional far-right politics and fascism. Because if you're in a situation where the president of the United States can call for Muslims to be banned for his country and refer to Mexican and Latin American immigrants as rapists and so on, then something fundamental has happened internal to conservative ideology.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because we always talk about the rise of the far right as though it's a failure of progressive politics to resist it. But actually, the people who show the worst resilience to it are those mainstream conservatives who show absolutely no resistance, and they seem almost discombobulated by the appearance of the far right. I mean, the Republicans in America are the best example of this. They seem to have a muscular atrophy in the face of Donald Trump because they don't know how to resist him when he's not their classic enemy. But nor can they collapse into him, so they're just frozen in time. And actually, exactly the same thing has happened in the UK in terms of kind of mainstream conservatism and the rhetoric of Brexit, which has unearthed a lot of far-right language and a lot of far-right terminology. There was a classic quote from a conservative minister talking about door-knocking among conservative constituencies and saying if you go into a house and there are books on the shelves, basically they're no longer voting conservative. So the kind of civilized right, if you like, the right that listens and the right that reads, has gone completely underground. And I wonder if that's the first line of defense, and the failure of that line of defense is the beginning of a far-right movement.
I think in the Austrian case, the new ÖVP or the ÖVP courts has instrumentalized the far-right and the far-right agenda in a very strategic way. Basically, the new ÖVP won the election by playing with the anti-immigration card, in a kind of softer rhetoric. Mm-hmm. But basically, that was the main agenda, so that, for example, the Peter Pils, who's a very well-known politician of the party Jetzt, which is a sort of split off of the Green Party, said Kurz is the better Strache. So basically, playing with the agenda of anti-migration and anti-Muslim brought the victory. So it wasn't the case that they were overwhelmed by the far right. They used that, and there's quite an interesting symbiosis, which I also believe to be the case in other countries. As long as you are in power, you don't do anything against the Trumps or similar, because the Republicans could have also done something against Trump, but they vote with Trump. And in that way, as I think it's also an opportunistic strategic game. As long as you are in power, there are very few who speak up. And that's also the case here in Austria. Even though there are strong voices in the conservative Christian Social Party, and we know that they don't agree, and sometimes they give an interview or they write an op-ed, but basically they play along because the party is in power. And I think one shouldn't neglect that part. I don't think they are driven by the far right. It's a quite nice symbiosis. It's a win-win situation for both.
But then why doesn't that have a cost for them? There should, if you look at the kind of historical arcs, be a huge electoral cost when you abandon the civilized norms of political discourse, but there doesn't seem to be.
Raphael, tell us about the Law and Justice Party in this context, because this is an interesting case for Europe.
Yes, I think you're right, because this example shows us it's a dynamic picture. The social norms or the norms of political culture shift. Back in the 90s, the then party of the founder of Law and Justice was not even called Law and Justice. It was called the Agreement of the Center. So it wasn't even calling itself right wing. When Law and Justice was established under the current name in the early 2000s, it was a center-right party with a conservative ideology, but it was very different from its current ideology. And it moved to the right step by step over the years. Eventually, it occupied the political space that used to be occupied by another party called the League of Polish Families, which was the far-right nationalist party that existed in Poland, that was even briefly in the government around the years 2006-2007. It doesn't really exist anymore, but Law and Justice took over most of the voters, but also much of the ideology of the League of Polish Families. And one important factor here is Radio Maria, that you may have heard about, yes. Which is not just a radio station, it's much more than that. It is also a kind of Catholic nationalist social and political movement, which provides an important symbolic framework for Law and Justice politics today. I also wanted to mention the Trump factor, because I think it is relevant to many countries, including Poland. As you may remember, Trump cancelled his visit to the UK in July 2017, that he went to Poland instead. And that was an important event in terms of legitimizing the political direction Poland has taken in the last years. And it was a really interesting case, a long speech he gave in a big square in the center of Warsaw, where he talked about Polish history, and that was interpreted as a kind of acceptance of the Polish nationalist view of Polish history. And it was maybe even more interesting for what didn't happen or what he didn't say. He didn't refer to democracy, he didn't refer to human rights. And he was the first US president in many decades who didn't visit the monument to the heroes of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. And that was also noted as a very positive fact by the Polish far right, that clearly felt further emboldened and empowered by this kind of gesture.
I just wanted to add to this important question, I think, of Zoe about the conservatives and the far right and how they might play together, the populist far right. Just again, referring to the Austrian case, I think it's a kind of symbiosis. So the far right, which is an anti-establishment party and actually stands for the little man and the little woman of the street, is implementing or is co-implementing policies which are against this electorate. Mm-hmm. So they have to satisfy them and keep them satisfied. And they do that in various ways, by keeping the anti-immigration agenda on the news and also by this nativist agenda and so forth. On the other hand, they get certain issues which are symbolic politics, like there is something against the headscarves in schools, mm-hmm. and the burqa was forbidden, and you can smoke again in restaurants, which was Strache's big wish because he's a smoker. And it seems absurd, but these are big issues, symbolic politics. On the other hand, Kurz gets, or the ÖVP gets, the neoliberal agenda, which is implementing suddenly 12-hour working days and 60-hour working weeks without the trade unions involved, and so-called flexibilization, cutting social benefits, etc., mm-hmm. which are directed against the sort of core electorate of the populist far right. So in that way, they play together.
So he wouldn't be able to get his kind of rolling back of the state away if he didn't have these nativist language around it.
Yeah, I think so.
That's interesting.
And so they need to keep both electorates somehow happy, and they seem to be doing well in the polls. So I see it a bit really as a, in my view, very unfortunate symbiosis.
Mm-hmm. Every now and again, I will give my advice when somebody asks for it, and they're listening to you. I didn't say that, but I think on occasions, if people ask, they'll take it into consideration. We're a nation state, right? We have a border, and if we want to put a wall on that border, we can do it.
Term has been introduced in the English language world of the Bannon playbook to describe the way in which the new far right come out and make a shocking statement in order to seize hold of the news agenda, dominate it for several days, and then shift the terrain of the debate and terrain of the discussions onto their issues. And one thing you saw, I think it was last summer in the UK, is that Boris Johnson was directly in text message communication with Bannon. He's discussing the future of Europe, discussing Brexit, discussing a range of other issues. I mean, this is a political figure who, when they were the mayor of London not so long ago now, celebrated his multiculturalism and his tolerance and his belief in compassionate conservatism, but then has entered this new political dialogue with the American far right and others. A week or so later, after these discussions with Bannon, wrote a very shocking op-ed where he referred to women who were wearing the burqa as letterboxes in this incredibly offensive way.
Bannon is, I think, looking at the textbook of demagogy, yes, and manipulation, because, again, you know, being provocative and creating scandals to distract from other possibly very hurtful policies is a very well-known means, and I think Bannon and also the FPÖ, Haider was very clever in this, is sort of dominating the news agenda. I called that in my book the perpetuum mobile of the far right. So you constantly provoke a scandal, then everybody has to report it.
Yeah.
It's recontextualized, and somebody says that's not what I meant and not what I said, and it's taken out of context, and then one can claim victimhood because one is sort of, there's a campaign against somebody, and so forth, and that wheel is sort of going on, and once one of these provocations has ended, and now there are even no apologies anymore, just, you know, the next provocation comes. And one of the dangers for traditional quality media is that they don't cut through this Gordian knot, that they don't sort of seize the agenda back and say, okay, actually we want to report about XYZ and maybe put this on page 12 or something, but not let ourselves be driven constantly by this provocation. That is obviously what Boris Johnson started doing and others in the UK. But every week we have a so-called, here in Austria, single incident, an Einzelfall. And the single incident is one of many incidents, but each of them are defined as single and exceptional, although they belong into a long narrative. And it's in, you know, something about insinuating something anti-Semitic or Nazi stuff or saying something unsayable. And so the whole media jumps on it.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it continues. And while this is happening, all the other policies are being decided upon, usually or now quite frequently, in very undemocratic ways.
Yeah.
So there's less time in parliament for expert opinions, there's less discussion, there's less question-answer sequences, so it's being hollowed out. But meanwhile, everybody's sort of occupied and involved into these provocative issues.
I mean, to go back for a second to your point about the symbiosis, if we are saying that the mainstream right needs the far right and the far right needs the mainstream right in order for the mainstream right to get through its economic agenda while the far right gets through its cultural agenda, are we basically saying then this is a function of economic meltdown? That if we were all prospering, none of this would be happening?
Well, I can now speak for Austria, and then Rafael will say something about Poland. In Austria, there was no big after effects of the economic crisis. It's not comparable to the UK.
Yeah.
I mean, I've lived in Lancaster for 12 years. I've seen the high street going down the drain, shops being closed. Everybody had somebody in their families who became unemployed. That was not the case here. Unemployment rose a bit, and there's a fear of losing out, but people didn't lose out in any way comparable to countries which were really hit by the crisis. Mm-hmm. So the fear is instrumentalized in a different way.
Well, actually, what I wanted to say, it might be very similar. Poland from what I remember, was the only country in the EU that didn't have a recession in the aftermath of the global crisis. Of course, it doesn't mean that it didn't suffer economic hardship just like everybody else. But relatively speaking, you might say Poland was lucky if you compare it to other countries like Greece or Latvia or other places.
Spain, of course.
You know, when we discuss those issues with some of my friends on the left, some of them would say, no, it's the economy, stupid. You know, it's about unemployment and issues like that. And when we fix that, there will be no far right anymore. And I think that's not necessarily correct, because when we look at the Polish far right that rose dramatically in the last couple of years, there are other factors at play, not just on the socioeconomic level. There are issues around identity and national identity and anxieties that are partly artificially created through far-right propaganda, but certainly the socio-economic factors don't seem sufficient.
But why is it then? I mean, it's not the economy, stupid, but what is it? Smart.
You go first.
Thank you. Well, I would say that the identity question is crucial. And I see Ivan Krastev sitting back there. You know, the refugee movement was absolutely a tipping point where the fear was created and then also instrumentalized for the demographic arguments. Yeah. So this fear of being overwhelmed, being invaded by Muslims and our culture, you know, the Occident being destroyed, etc., is an amazing fear. Obviously, that has been crucial, at least in Eastern Europe. It's interesting in Austria and also in Switzerland and Denmark, which are all very rich countries, small countries, the identity question became salient, and the national identity in different ways. But all of these countries basically were not hit by the financial crisis. Yeah? So it's not in any way comparable to other countries in Europe. And so I think that in these countries, the welfare chauvinism is so strong. You want to preserve the achievements of the post-war for us. Yeah? It's basically national socialism. Yeah? So you want to preserve this social welfare, and these are all, you know, Scandinavian models, social welfare countries with still huge benefits, wonderful health care, etc., etc. The Danes are supposed to be the happiest people on earth. So to preserve that for us, and the fear that you would lose that is enormous. And that can be culturalized very easily. Who will take that away and they don't belong to us? So there you have a different explanation than in those societies which became very polarized, very different, because Greece became polarized. The far right didn't take over. Actually, Syriza took over. Yeah. So it's a very different story. The same in Portugal. You have a social democratic government. It's actually a success story and a very different story than the countries where the far right is emerging so successfully, and that preserved the social benefits and worked against the austerity politics. Portugal is a very interesting case because you don't have a populist far right.
Mm-hmm. Did they ever have a populist far right?
Well, they had fascism.
To generate the social movement we see now, because in Greece that was certainly sparked by Golden Dawn, but in Portugal
Golden Dawn has a long history, and Greece had a civil war post-World War II, and the far right has always been strong in Greece. Remember the dictatorship and so forth. Portugal had Salazar and fascism, but since then, conservative and social democratic governments, but not a reemergence of this far right. Spain now has a reemergence, which is interesting, probably due also in instrumentalizing the refugees which are landing in Spain. Mm-hmm. But Portugal just said no to the EU austerity politics, which is really an interesting issue. Mm-hmm.
Poland, historically, used to be one of the most diverse multicultural nations in the whole of Europe. today, as a result of World War II, the Holocaust, the border changes, deportations, etc., today Poland is one of the most homogeneous mono-ethnic societies in the whole of Europe. And I think in a way, it has not managed to deal with the identity issue that results from those dramatic events in Polish history, and especially in the 20th century. That is one of the paradoxes explaining at least partly why ethnic nationalism is so strong, despite the fact that the minority groups, the Jewish community is so tiny, that the Muslim community is very small too. But the levels of both anti-Semitism and Islamophobia are relatively high. And I think there is no denying the dramatic impact the year 2015 had also on Poland. And again, paradoxically, despite the fact that the refugee crisis in the south of Europe didn't really impact Poland in any meaningful way, because very, very few of those refugees ever made it to Poland or were going to,
Poland didn't want to go to Poland.
But that coincided with the electoral campaign. So we had different right-wing and far-right groups and parties competing on who will be more anti-migrant, anti-refugee, and anti-Muslim. The supposed threat of refugees arriving in Poland was framed in a very negative way in the media. And the repercussions of that particular moment are still with us. I had been dealing with the issue of far-right and xenophobia for more than two decades, but I wasn't really aware that the level of hate speech and the level of hate crime could be correlated so clearly, so visibly. The levels of hate speech rose dramatically, and so did the number of hate crimes immediately in the summer of 2015. That is something that we clearly saw. And the repercussions of those weeks are still with us. But we were often told Islamophobia replaced antisemitism as the main type of hate on the Polish right. And I was never sure about it, and I thought it is probably more appropriate to say it supplemented antisemitism rather than replaced it. And in a way, that was proved correct last year. But then again, I have to admit, I didn't expect there could be a wave of antisemitism in the mainstream of Polish politics and media on that scale. I knew antisemitism existed on the far right in Poland, but I didn't think I would live to see that kind of explosion of antisemitic sentiment in the mainstream media. And of course, there was this controversy around the Polish Holocaust memory law that sparked it. But what I thought was even more problematic was the kind of discourse that went with it. And I think repercussions will be with us for many more years to come.
I find it interesting that 2015 has been mentioned by both of you. Looking at it from this British perspective, unfortunately, in some ways. But 2015 wasn't such a negative moment in Britain in terms of the immediate impacts of the refugee crisis, particularly when the young toddler Alan Kurdi died, the refugee in the Aegean coastline. I think many of you will have seen. There was a huge outpouring of sympathy and actually a lot of pressure in the British public space to match the Merkel offer, which wasn't realised and Cameron rejected it and so on. But the pressure was there to say Britain should open up to the refugee crisis, but they didn't. And then a year later, it's a tale of 2 years. 2016 happens. We have a referendum campaign around Brexit in the EU where the refugee question is completely instrumentalised. We had Breaking Point posters by Nigel Farage. You know, it's often claimed by the mainstream campaign, Vote Leave, Take Back Control, that they didn't engage in this nasty rhetoric, even though they sent out leaflets to every single house in the UK that said, with a big arrow pointing from Turkey, Britain's new border is with Syria and Iraq.
Our political discourse draws no distinction between refugees and migrants. It's that, you know, they are all foreign. They are all problematic. There's very little distinction drawn between EU migrants and non-EU migrants.
Yeah.
But is that true of Hungary, Poland, Austria?
No. So there's a big distinction between people from the EU member states and migrants. Mm-hmm. And then also sometimes refugees. Yeah, so basically we have three categories, if you want to say so. They're, of course, not quite so sharp categories. But basically, I was struck when I was living in Britain and we did a big project at Lancaster University looking at the representation of refugees, migrants and asylum seekers in the British press, including The Guardian, over 10 years. And it was striking to see how those categories were merged. In one article, you would have migrant and then refugee and then bogus asylum seeker and then whatnot, yeah? And they were all, you know, sort of synonymous, although they're very different. So in Britain, there was no distinction between migration in the EU, where also many British people live in France and in Spain and travel and do all what everybody else does, and from outside, and then refugees, which is totally different. We looked at the reporting from 1996 to 2006, so 10 years, all British national newspapers, and only the Financial Times didn't merge that. I mean, wow, even The Guardian did some of it. But very little. And if you now look, the discourse has shifted again, because now everybody talks about illegal migrants. Now, that is a very interesting category because it doesn't make sense. So you don't distinguish anymore in Austria, for example, you don't distinguish anymore between asylum seekers, refugees, and migrants who come more or less voluntarily.
Right.
And all of them are called illegal migrants. And so this whole discourse about building walls and closing borders, etc., is about keeping illegal migrants out. And I've had a discussion with some lawyers. I wanted to know about the legal definitions of these terms. Illegal migrant, I was told, only makes sense if somebody asked for asylum, applied for asylum, let's say in this country, was rejected and could have been deported back to a safe country. Yeah, so his or her country of origin would be safe, not Syria or a country in war, and nevertheless stayed and hid or ran away or did something.
Only
in that case can we speak about illegal migrants. Otherwise, they're applicants, they're refugees, they're migrants, they're asylum seekers. There are many other terms which are legal terms. That has been completely merged now. If you read, for example, the government program of the now Austrian government, you don't find the term refugee anymore. So it's all been substituted by illegal migration. And so that has really been recontextualized and redefined as the new term, although it's completely wrong.
What do they want, the far right? As a kind of political vision, what is the country that they want to live in? I mean, you know,
What does peace want?
Well, we all know the term that has been making rounds, illiberal democracy. And of course, in some ways, that makes sense, but in some other ways, maybe it's an oxymoron. I think in the Polish case, the slogan that we know very well from history, Poland for the Polish, is at the heart of the far-right politics. But of course, it assumes a very specific understanding of what it means to be Polish, of who belongs and who does not belong. And in fact, it's not just about ethnicity. It is deeper than that. It is also about ideology. That's why the right-wing propaganda has often referred to critics and opponents as traitors. There is a word in Polish which goes back to the 18th century, the word Targowica. Targowica was a town where a group was formed that called for Russia to intervene. Catherine the Great was asked to intervene in Poland. This term, Targowica, is the synonym of treason in the Polish language. And this is the term that state television uses every day to describe the political opposition. especially in the last couple of weeks. That has been a really important and painful subject, especially in the context of the killing of the mayor of Gdańsk, who had been the target of hateful propaganda, including on state television. So once again, we realize it's not just about words, it's not just about symbols. This is the kind of propaganda that could also have a tragic impact on people's lives.
Just also not quite going back to Catherine the Great, but Austria First was the slogan of Haider's petition 1992-93. So America First is, again, not new as a slogan. I think it's very much about this nativist vision of the white Christian Europe with a very conservative gender politics, where if you read the program of the Austrian Freedom Party, which everybody can download from their website, you see that women should not work outside of house, that there should be no abortion, right? So it's going back decades. It's like, you know, going back to the 1950s or earlier, going back to nature is part of this vision as well. The blood and soil imagery comes up, and you can find that as a vision. Plus, then for Austria, it's Pan-Germanic, and then comes the emphasis on the German language and the German culture and so forth. So there is a very clear ideology, and it's very explicit. Yeah, it's called the Handbook of the Freedom Party Politics, and the preface is written by Strache and Norbert Hofer, who had been the candidate for president 2016. And if you read it, it has all of these issues and values stated very explicitly.
Yeah, yeah.
It's really still the white Christian Europe, which is the vision, and everything else doesn't belong.
I think we should open it up to the audience. I mean, the main thing the far right want in Britain is Brexit. So if you can give us any advice on how to stop that with 6 weeks to go, we'll be very grateful in the questions. Should we go here first?
I have just a short question. What is your opinion about the close relationship of far-right-wing parties to Moscow, to Russia, especially FPÖ? They have even an agreement with the Russian party close to President Putin. Then you have the financing of Lega Nord, of Marine Le Pen, Front National from Russia. And it's only different with Poland, as we know. Yeah. But otherwise, what is your opinion? Thank you.
Take another one. Yeah.
So in Romania, the far right is very linked to the church, and the church is like the strong arm of the far right movement. And I was curious, like in the other countries, in Austria and in Poland, how potent is the church and how strongly it's connected to these movements? And I also have like a more general question, which is fear, because fear seems to be the key word. Why is fear so potent and so easy to instrumentalize?
Okay, Putin, church, fear.
Russia first. You know, Polish history vis-a-vis Russia is complicated. But there is also an important sort of tradition on the Polish far right that's actually pro-Russian, and it still exists. The current government and the ruling party is very anti-Russian in its official language, but there are some surprising facts about the relationship that may suggest it's, again, more complex than that. It was interesting to see Mr. Salvini visiting Poland a few weeks ago, and from what was reported about the meeting with the leadership of the Polish ruling party, it looks like they reached an agreement for the European election this year, and they said they agree on 90% of things. They don't agree on 10%, and I think that was probably about the Russian connection. So we will see what happens next. But the question about the church, of course, is very relevant to the Polish case, and the issue of religion is a very important issue vis-a-vis Polish national identity. I mentioned already Radio Maria as a social movement that is ostensibly a Catholic movement, but I would argue it might be wrong to interpret it in terms of religion. I would argue it's more of a political movement, and it's first and foremost a nationalist movement. To give you an example, Pope Francis is very unpopular among the Polish nationalists who call themselves Roman Catholic, but they hate the Pope. To give you an example, yes, he's too pro-refugee, he's pro-migrant, pro-gay, pro-everything. They don't like that for sure. To give you an example you may find difficult to believe, but it's actually a real example from last year in Krakow. They prayed for the death of the Pope.
No.
I would say that's an extreme example of disagreeing with the leader of your own church, which shows there is a problem of identity within the Polish Catholic Church. And the Archbishop of Krakow was asked what he thinks about it, and he said he actually invited the priest who did it, he invited him for a conversation, and he told him not to do it in future. But there was no punishment, so I think there is also a question of discipline and the implosion of hierarchy and authority in the Polish Catholic Church. But we also have pagans who are anti-Christian. It's a small part of the right-wing spectrum, but it also exists. And they all come together, for example, on the 11th of November, which is the annual Independence Day march in Warsaw, where different nationalist groups come together and they happily march hand in hand, the Catholics, the pagans. So they're united by something else, that is nationalism, which trumps the different disagreements.
So about Putin, it's interesting. Yeah? Well, it seems that a lot of the ideology or the politics of Russia, and I'm not a political scientist, but what we see matches very well the ideologies of the far right, both on gender politics. So I've already mentioned gender politics is a real issue. You know, this macho habitus, the homophobia in Russia. So the Freedom Party in its handbook also is homophobic. The nationalism. So there are many ways to reach out. And of course, the anti-left, anti-communism and so forth, where it's interesting that Putin comes from the KGB originally, but, you know. And of course, also the aggression and drive against the media. So the managed media and the way the media are suppressed, most of them, at least the official hegemonic media in Russia, is also something which is wanted by the far right in Austria. Yeah, and they have already started, as you know, to launch attacks against the OAF and some journalists, etc. So there are these connections, and it's interesting now again in this symbiosis, I think, of the pro-European conservatives, where it's well known that Russia actually is against the EU. They don't do anything against the conversation between the far right and Russia. So again, you have this interesting laissez-faire politics there. The church in Austria, especially the NGOs, were very much helping the refugees. Maybe some parts of the church are also quite conservative, but all in all, the church does not support the far right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The question about fear. Now, instrumentalizing fear is probably, again, of the handbook of demagogy, one of the most appealing methods. You create fear, you instrumentalize fear, both quite genuine fear, but then also exaggerated, pretended fear, and then you create hope. Yeah, so you will kind of solve that problem, you will take this fear away, you are saving the people, and that is exactly what the Trumps and Le Pens and so forth promised to do. So fear is coupled with the promise of salvation in a also quite religious sense.
Okay, we'll take this one, and then Shalini had her hand up as well. Okay.
Thank you. I wanted to, at this point in the conversation, raise the Lenin question. Что делать? What is to be done? Or maybe a version of that that Mr. Cooper asked early on is, what alternatives are needed? We heard a lot in terms of diagnosis, explanation of what is going on, but relatively little about precisely the alternatives question, which seems to me the most difficult next to the Lenin one. And I wanted to also, just as a provocation, suggests one answer. Just listening to you, it seemed to me that one alternative that emerges is strengthening traditional conservatism, right? Perhaps less Rosa Luxemburg and more something that would bring back the electorate toward the center from the extreme. Thank you.
And At the back, Shalini had her hand up.
Actually, my intuition, although I think it may be a good idea to strengthen the traditional conservatives, my intuition goes in the opposite direction. I think there's one factor which is missing in the analysis of the whole right-wing rise and the coupling of it with the migration story, which is that it came after the crisis of the welfare state. And the crisis of the welfare state was a homemade crisis, nothing external. It was, unfortunately, the Social Democrats who abandoned the welfare state. And this is true of the Labour as much as the Democrats, as is true of the SPD and the SPÖ. Now, given that, I think we really have a problem, because the problem is the following. Think of Poland, for example. It's the new government which is giving this very high childcare benefit. It's 150 euros, which is a lot of money per child. So you could say this is a wonderful left kind of redistribution policy, which should give you support for a redistributive agenda. It doesn't, because in every country in which we see it at the moment, it's coupled with ethno-nationalism. So it's about funding the real Poles. The same is true here, where it's about welfare, yes, but only for a section, because the political community must be now defined ethnically. So those migrants who have been living here since ages should not, their children, if they're living outside of Austria, should not get the same social benefits. So I think the redefinition of what the social benefits should be, coupled to an ethnic definition of the political community, I think is one of the major problems, because the socialist parties are caught on the back foot. With their clientele, it's very difficult for them to argue those who have not put in anything into the pot should now be getting a large share out of it. So I think unless something can be changed in the rhetoric. So the distribution policies are there, but the rhetoric has changed completely. So I think unless those can be justified differently in terms of a different kind of logic of distribution, of fairness, I think we really have a problem in making a left argument against this.
And there was one more at the back, and then there were two there.
Franz Priller from the Erste Foundation in Vienna. One thing struck me just now when also Shalini was talking, I think the issue about the socialists being no longer able to stand up for their own values, I think it's partly also because they lost the integrative aspect of what socialism stood for. Socialism was an integrative ideology. Everybody should be able to participate. Everybody should be able to have a stake. That was lost. And no amount of welfare statism, just handing out money, could substitute for that if that core is gone. And I think that core is gone to a very large extent. And it's gone in the face of also, of course, nativism, etc., that is happening. So whether this can actually ever be regained, I'm doubtful. So I would also tend more towards strengthening the sort of center-right again, rather than trying to revive the socialist parties. However, I had another question. Do you think an American populist, extremist, some would say, is really able to influence what is happening in Europe and the European Union? I'm not talking about the disastrous person in the White House. I'm talking about Bannon. And Bannon has been mentioned. He came to Europe. He set up a foundation in Brussels. He wants to change things here. Is he really having an influence? Does anybody know what is actually happening with him? And whether the yellow vests in France are his creation or not?
Okay. And there's one at the back.
I would like to come back to the last questions. I would say that we have two currents of the nationalist right, rather neoliberal one in the northwest of Europe and partially in the Visegrad countries, those who want to continue the FDI-led model like Sloboda Solidarita in Slovakia, and on the other hand, rather national conservative-oriented parties, which in the Visegrad countries see certain limits to the export-led growth like Poland and Hungary, Fidesz and PiS, and in declining industrial countries, France and Italy, Lega and Rassemblement National. Both currents, I think, are addressing a multi-class audience, and they have different forms of exclusion to offer to different audiences. On the one hand, to the middle class in the West, it is no transfers to the South. For the working class and the lower middle class, it is an exclusionary welfare state. In the Visegrad countries, it is protecting So domestic capital, at least in certain sectors, in a more encompassing way, I would say, in the case of Poland, in the case of Fidesz, it is for the businessmen around the party. But regarding the social alliance, I would say Hungary and Poland are different. It is rather inclusionary in the case of Poland, at least class-wise, whereas in Hungary it is a very strongly neoliberal social policy against the poor, against the Roma, so with strongly exclusionary moments. So far, I would say even this center-periphery divide or core-periphery divide we have not been talking about today, so far is visible in the programs as well, yeah? So, and in the orientation. And I think we can classify certain things. Yeah?
And the two here, and then we'll come back to the front.
We see it in Poland that the state of law is systematically undermined. We see it in Hungary. And recently we all have heard the nice sentence of Mr. Kickl that the law has to follow politics, not the other way around. Mrs. Wodak, you would say this is one of the numerous incidences. I would say it is more. It is an element in this strategy to undermine the state of law. One tries it with a nice, well-calculated sentence, but it is an element in a broader picture. So state of law is undermined. And my second point is with regard to the welfare aspect. We have heard it, the various aspects. I would like to add one more. We have just seen in Italy that there is the unconditional income now paid 780 euros per month to 5 million people. This would mean, if you calculate it, nearly 50 billion euro, which Italy does not have. So this is decided now, as it is said in the newspapers. And my question is the consequences of that, because there's no chance that Italy respects the European rules. So the welfare aspect is not only the differentiation issue and some people get it, some others don't get it, and so on and so forth. But I think there is this broader picture on the consequences for the European Union, because Italy will not respect, if they really follow through this concept, the rules of the European Union, with all the consequences which that might have.
And there's one at the back.
A very tiny commentary to your analysis, Ruth. I totally agree. I have one proposal of a differentiation, arguing that until the mid-1980s, the Freedom Party was a small party of old brown boys, yesterday men. With Haider, this was a transformation, and so the Freedom Party became to some extent an avant-garde of right-wing movement in Europe, but I don't think that we disagree at that point. I didn't want to speak about Italy, but for me, Italy is a disastrous example of a coalition between a left and a right-wing political party. Then it's very clear for me that this five-star movement came from the very left. Yeah? It was anti-Berlusconi. It became popular in the Berlusconi time. And both parties try to give these gifts to their people. Yeah? And this is a disaster in my view. Yeah? But I want to come back to Shalini's comment. I also would say that there's a deep connection between the crisis of the democratic left parties and the race of the right wing, to some extent to the left wing populist parties. One can see this, for example, also in the Brexit issue, why the Labour Party is not able to make a strong alternative to the Brexiteers, for example. Yeah? Or the Social Democratic Party in Austria is not able to develop realistic and humanitarian alternative to our people with regard to refugees, with regard to migrants, etc. I agree with the differentiation. I think this is very, very important. The only chance, in my view, a Democratic Left Party would have is to renew, to redefine what is a social welfare state under complete different economic and political definition, but on a transnational level. Yeah? This is a harsh, but on a long run, the only way to fight against right-wing populism. Thank you.
There's so much there.
Well, if somebody's got to say something about what's to be done, right?
I can try. Yeah. I don't really have solutions. I will not pretend I have them, but let me mention one or two things from the Polish perspective that you may find interesting. One aspect of the current Polish situation is the absence of the left. There is not a single left party or even left of center party in the Polish parliament. Even the sort of Blairite social democrats disappeared from the parliament in 2015. So Polish politics today, when it comes to mainstream politics, is all about different shades of the right, which is a very peculiar situation, yeah. I have to say. This whole issue of building an alternative, as you can imagine, is very much under discussion, but it's a very difficult one. I think, broadly speaking, there are two answers in Poland now. One is, you may call it a democratic front. Yeah? So there are people who would say, well, it's an extraordinary situation. All the democratic forces should unite because democracy as such is under threat. The rule of law, the basic constitutional principles, the freedom of the media, the basic democratic values are under threat, and that requires a special attitude, leaving differences behind in the name of unity. And I can understand that kind of argument. There is another kind of argument that goes, there is no return to the liberal democratic system we had. We have to build something completely new, you know, rebuild the left, rebuild the progressive alternative that may take longer, but it may have better, longer-term results. And as some of you may have heard, just yesterday, a new political party was created in Poland by a good friend of mine, Robert Biedroń. The name of the party is Spring. The idea is to build a new progressive movement that would be attractive to the new generation in a different way. I wish Robert well, but I think it's a very ambitious undertaking. Generally speaking, I'm full of worries for Polish democracy. I'm not hiding it. There are not many reasons for optimism, I'm afraid, because I think the crisis that we face goes beyond party politics. It's a very deep crisis of democratic culture and democratic values. And I think it's a more general breakdown in human empathy, if we can call it that, which I think is very profound. Just one sentence about Bannon. I'm not an expert on French politics, but I think this initiative is interesting because, of course, it reflects the phenomenon that you could call internationalization of nationalism. And I think he is finding it more difficult than he expected. But from what I understand, he has a role in building this new sort of alliance with Italy, Hungary, Poland, maybe France, Le Pen. So I think we should watch out for what happens next on that level. That should be interesting.
Well, what I heard about Bannon's influence is that it wasn't so very big, not for the AfD, not for the FPÖ, and also not for the Front National or the Rassemblement National now. So his appeal doesn't seem to be so enormous. But of course, his ideology coincides with a lot which is here. It might emphasize, it might contribute to it in that way. I also would like to say something very briefly on the crisis of the welfare state. I mean, that is why the welfare chauvinism, which I mentioned, is so important in Denmark, Austria, Germany, yeah, in these countries which are rich, Switzerland. Switzerland is usually not talked about, but Switzerland had the biggest far-right populist party for a very long time and is the richest country in the world, or the second richest country in the world after Norway. And in Norway, the far-right is also in government. So I think we really need to look at this aspect very strongly. And that is why I mentioned Portugal, because that is so interesting, because they rejected the austerity politics and made it. Now, you can say Portugal is small and this, that, and the other, and it might not work elsewhere. But what I read about it, and I'm not an expert at all on Portugal, but what I read about it is the Germans, especially Schäuble, was pressing very hard that everybody said this government will collapse after half a year, and they didn't. So it's very much about finding a new narrative. I've been thinking about an alternative narrative for some time, and I came up with a title, which is, instead of having this narrative that we should go back retro, make America great again to something white, Christian, dada, we should have back to the future. So if we should turn around and look in the future and find something for this diverse future. It needs to be a positive narrative, but a complex one. It can't be simplistic. And it should not only be for the conservative right, but also for the center-left. I mean, I think the class society as such doesn't exist that way anymore. We have a much stronger emphasis on values, and that has to be addressed. So if you think about the big challenges, which are not talked about like climate change, all these big challenges can only be coped with internationally and together. So there has to be a new narrative emphasizing the other challenges and not just migration and so forth. And the way everybody needs everybody to cope with it. I mean, all the migrants are actually paying into the pot. Mm-hmm. It's not like they come here, especially migrants, pay taxes. Mm-hmm. They are part and parcel. And I was thinking, having been in London now for a week, I thought London would collapse if migrants would have to leave. No more restaurants, no more hospitals, no more universities. I mean, 50% of London's population would leave. You need to make this concrete and also try and formulate, and I think this is not easy, but it has to be emotional. The left has frequently been much too instrumental and rational in its language. I mean, there are many emotions. Solidarity has always been an emotional issue. But instead of just addressing fear and destruction and apocalyptic images, you have to address other emotions.
Yeah, no, I was thinking about this point about the collapse of the welfare state and how that, and not the anti-immigrant language, was at the root of it. And I think I'm probably going to land ultimately with your transnational benefit, but coming at it from a different direction. I don't know enough about the European context, but I know that in the UK context, that period of rescinding the social state and basically cutting benefit recipients off at the knee was marked by extreme violence of language against welfare recipients. I was thinking about you saying the state media calling people traitors who didn't agree. In England, we don't have state-controlled media. Rather, we have a media-controlled state. So you have this very violent press calling people traitors regularly, and then the politics responding to them. It's a bit like how British politicians are very hard to corrupt, because you can basically corrupt them for the price of a Kit Kat. So it's impossible to detect. If somebody doesn't need very much money, then it's impossible to detect where the corruption has come from, but the corruption is nevertheless there. There was a period from before 2010, actually, of extremely violent language against benefit recipients and anybody in receipt of the social state. And I think what it did was it made people feel that their citizenship was contested. It was very easy from there to make them respond angrily to immigrants, because if your citizenship is uncontested, then of course immigrants aren't a problem. But if you are only by your fingertips considered a thing of value to your own nation, being told that immigrants are not net recipients, pay more tax than they receive, keep the health service afloat, that doesn't cut any ice with you at all, because you're dealing with your own position in your own country being infinitely contested, an act of violence really against the sense of your value as a citizen in your nation. So I think in a way the thing to rediscover in the language on the left is that Lakoff idea of a nation's wealth being indivisible from a nation's people, of the people being the resource of the nation. Because I think if we have better resilience against segments of the population being victimized, then we would have better resilience against the right then instrumentalizing that sense of victimhood. And, you know, ironically, you get back to Ursula Hirschman's point about the foundations of the EU, that the point of a kind of non-bordered identity, citizenly identity and political identity is that only a nation can repudiate you. Only a nation can say you no longer belong here because you're not productive enough, or you're not healthy enough, or you're not white enough, or you're not pure enough. Only a bordered nation can do that to you. Across borders, these decisions are made collectively and nobody can eject you. So if you're trying to remake a sense of citizenship as something that couldn't be taken away from you, you would land naturally at a kind of cross-bordered set of solutions.
I wanted to come back to this question of Putin and Bannon, because I think in some ways they're similar questions. They're both about how European societies are being in some ways penetrated by what's happening elsewhere and this new nationalist internationalism that we see. I mean, for me, in a way, I think this is one of the points of continuity between the old nationalism and the old fascism and the new nationalism, because the old fascism was also networked and highly integrated and had common conferences together and built international diplomatic alliances and so on, and the new nationalism is as well. One of the lesser known examples that I like to mention occasionally is the case of the American president Warren Harding, who came from the state of Ohio and was president from 21 to 23. And he is often credited, and it probably was said somewhere else beforehand, but often associated with the slogan America First. And what was interesting about his legacy in a way is that there were lots and lots of German immigrants in Ohio and Pennsylvania at the time. Lots of them provided the bedrock and would provide the bedrock for the appeasement movement towards Hitler in the 1930s. And I think it brings to light the really messy way that communication and geopolitics get messed up together. I think one of the things you see with the new far right, again, the same as the old far right, you know, the further along you go on the spectrum of extremism, the more that race comes to trump nation. So a good example of this, someone who's become much more prominent in recent years, is Richard Spencer in the United States. I mean, he describes himself as a revolutionary nationalist, a revolutionary Nazi. And interestingly enough, he rejects American nationalism and promotes a white settler state in the territory of North America that would become a homeland for white people fleeing a Muslim Europe, essentially. So race comes to trump nation. And then on the question of what do we do, and I think a couple of questions said, you know, in a way we need the centre-right embracing its liberal values again. I'm not of the centre-right, as you can tell, but I fully support this. I mean, I just would express disappointment with the centre-right's current ability to do this. I mean, Orbán is still a member of the European People's Party in my home country, in the UK. The most one-nation conservatives, I would say, are the Scottish Conservative MPs. And ask yourself, where have the Scottish MPs, given Scotland voted overwhelmingly against Brexit, where have they been in the Brexit debate? And they're missing in action, I'm afraid. They're not prepared to stand up and promote it. And one of the things I've been shocked a lot of times over the last few years about what's happened in Britain, but I mean, last week in the House of Commons, there was a vote that was purely symbolic. So it didn't actually mean anything. The amendment that was being voted on even said this doesn't mean anything and it doesn't bind the government to do anything. But a vote against no deal was passed by 8 votes. And it didn't bind the government to do it. And one of the things that has left me incredibly frustrated with the discussion in Britain about Brexit and no deal is that it's all about the economic consequences. And for me, the most dangerous thing about this support for no deal isn't really about the economic consequences, although they're clearly very severe. It's the mentality that is animating the vote. So when 42% of your population is prepared to say we should break our international alliances, refuse to pay them all the money that we've committed to pay them in the past, I'm afraid this is an increasingly fascistic mentality. It's tearing up the basis for the legal order in Europe. It's that dangerous. And so in that context, I think we do need an alliance of all Democrats to protect the democratic order in Europe, and that has to embrace everyone that wants to support democracy and the rule of law and everything. Thanks.
This podcast was sponsored by the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation, funded by the German federal government, and hosted by the Institute of Human Sciences in Vienna. Thanks to our guests, and thanks to you for listening. If you've enjoyed today's podcast, please tell someone about it. Better still, leave us a rating or review on your podcast platform. You can also feedback to us on Twitter at @another_Europe, or you can find us at facebook.com/anotherEuropeisPossible. We'll be back very soon. See you then.